Hello, and welcome to Conversations with Close, coming to you from the Great White North. I'm Michael Close, glad to have you with us. On this podcast, you'll hear interviews with magicians from around the planet. I try to ask questions designed to spark robust discussions, giving you information and insights you won't find anywhere else. If you enjoy these podcasts, I hope you'll stop by michaelclose.com and check out the products we have available there. And now, let's get into today's podcast. My guest today, an old friend, and certainly one of the most important figures of magic publishing of the 20th and 21st century, fellow responsible for some of the great magic books that have ever been published. Also the editor of Genie Magazine, the organizer of the Genie Convention, and in his copious free time, whatever that may be, collects all that crap you see in the room behind him there. Richard Kaufman. Richard, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you.
I see you have a long list of my nefarious activities.
You have been a busy man. You have been a busy man. I've often wondered about your work ethic. I mean, if you go back to the early books, like, say, the Roth book, where you were not only writing the tricks, but also illustrating all the tricks. I mean, this is a job, I guess it's a young man's job that when you have unlimited energy, but still.
That goes back to 1976, no, 74. No, maybe 72 when I was 14. That's when I started drawing. So I illustrated Harry Lorraine's book Afterthoughts in 1975 when I was 15. And then I was writing and drawing a lot. The first big book was Card Magic in 1979, 1,000 illustrations. And of course, back then the layout was manual, so I glued down every drawing, glued down every block of text, drew every box around every illustration with a pen, glued down every page number, every illustration number. And it was that way for Card Magic, Card Works, Jean May's Card Book, Coin Magic, Dingle, Roth, Hammond, Williamson.
Same.
Yeah, crazy. I was working... 12, 14 hours a day.
Yeah.
Now I start work at 11 a.m. and finish at 10 p.m. with breaks for lunch and dinner. And that's it.
Wow. Wow. So you're like me to a certain extent, which is my lifestyle changed very little during the pandemic because I was never anybody to really go a lot of places anyway. I mean, I know you like to visit your Disneyland parks, but
I'm basically
solitary.
I travel to quite a few magic conventions each year. But yes, for the most part, my wife and I, Liz, we both work at home. We've always worked at home. I've never had a real job. So, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, the pandemic has made it kind of difficult just in terms of concentration. But even so, when I first saw what was happening at the end of February, I dove into the third Jennings book, not Jennings Takes It Easy, but Jennings Takes It Tough. And I wrote 500 pages of that book, the third book. And I got sort of in November, I sort of hit a wall, the pandemic wall, they call it.
Yeah.
And, so I switched to a different project, which is a big book of Jean-Pierre Valerino's.
Oh, wow. Great.
Cards and Coins. And I hired John Lovick to write that. And so since November, I've been rewriting and linking the photos with the text and the videos for the DVD that'll go in the book with the text and all that nonsense.
Yeah. And then in the middle of doing all that, to get the magazine out every month. Now, I did it for 9 years, and I realized that to some extent, working for an independent magazine, I mean, a magazine that's not affiliated with an organization, has a different vibe to it because you're not sort of beholden to people whose opinions you may or may not find valid.
There is nobody above me in terms of genie.
Yeah, exactly.
Genie is a, this I learned early on after I started we started late 1998.
Right.
I quickly learned that an independent magazine is very much a projection of the editor's personality. So in my case, I have Asperger's syndrome. I have sort of a laser-like focus on things. So after flailing around for the first part of the year, we started doing these very long articles or these issues that were sort of bulging. Genie goes to Japan with content, tricks, and all kinds of things. And that sort of long focus suited me. We did that for years. But somewhere along the line, it becomes very tiring. So we move toward more columns, more columnists, and a shorter feature story. Now, I say shorter. It's still 20 pages usually each month, which is much longer than what anybody else has done or is doing. But we also have, you know, half a dozen columnists and The Eye and Magic Canna and stuff like that.
Yeah.
People seem to like it.
I think it's fantastic. It is the premier magic magazine and has been the premier magic magazine for quite a few years. And that was also, you know, the idea of having columnists was the only way that I could figure out that I could sort of guarantee consistent content over the course of 12 months, I would.
MUM was an easy job. You had only a certain number of pages on which to project your personal interest. So much of it was taken up from SAM Jibber Jabber.
Well, yes, but that may be true that I didn't have to develop or cultivate that content, but I did have to edit it. I did have to read it. I was the only guy, I think, who read the assembly reports every month.
Well, that would be the ice pick in the ear for me.
It was not easy. It was not easy.
You know, it's gotten much more difficult because advertising has dwindled,
of course,
to such an extent whereas we used to have 35 to 40 pages of ads in an issue, now it's a fraction of that, which means we have to fill those pages with content, whereas before we did not. So we actually have more content than ever before.
But doesn't that influence you're still sending out a physically printed magazine every month.
Yes.
If you're putting out the same pages without the advertising to offset those the cost of those pages, that's got to catch up with you at some point, doesn't it?
I caught up with this long ago, and here's where Randy Pitchford enters into the picture, because Genie would certainly have gone the same way as Magic Magazine, which went bankrupt, and we would have, the same thing would have happened to us. Sorry, I take care of something. Had not been for Randy, who subsidizes the publication of Genie, and for that, everyone in the magic community should be extremely grateful.
Indeed.
Genie loses quite a bit of money. And of course, it's become worse in the pandemic.
Right.
So many people in our field have no jobs. They've had no income. They're worried about paying the rent and eating. They're not worried about getting their magic magazine. So,
yeah.
So, Randy's like the king of the world, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, we do owe him a big debt of gratitude for keeping that going, because all magazine advertising, of course, got hit really hard because nobody advertised. I mean, it's all online now. So it's a new world. It's a new strange world. Is there a project you did? Now, some of the projects that you've done are, perhaps the word obsession isn't quite right, but they
obsession is exactly right.
I'm thinking of Tenyoism.
Every large book, And that would go back to Card Magic in 19, well, came out in 79, but I would have been writing it from 75 onward. You have to be obsessed to write a book of 150,000 words, draw 1,000 illustrations, travel to some place and sit down with a person for weeks. I mean, when I did the Burglass book, I have 100 hours of video, because every time I would go to England, and I went 7 or 8 times, I just sat the video camera down next to me and we talked. And that went for 100 hours all told. So that's how much time I've spent with David Burglass. And same thing with Dingle, same thing with Roth, same thing with Brother Hammond. You know, all these people, when you spend that much time with people, you become good friends with them.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I've done books with some people like Ron Wilson. I say we were friendly, but certainly he came and stayed with me in New York when I shot the video and shot the photos. But we weren't close after that. But I was very close with Derek, with Larry, friendly with David Roth, close with Burglass, close with Hammond. I mean, the lifelong friendships form with quite a few of these people. It's so very intense, you know, when you're working with somebody every day. I don't sit the camera on a tripod when I'm working with them. I've got the camera up, or in the early days, on my shoulder. I'm on the floor. I'm behind them. I'm under their armpit. You know, it's the only way to do things.
Yeah. And I think there's also an intensity there because you are basically, for people like Hammond and Dingle and for Roth at the time, you're capturing their life's work.
Yes.
You are in charge now of, you are the, the guy who's carrying this memory forward. And, you know, there's an intensity there. It's an interesting, I've never really written anybody else's book, but,
it's obsession, but it's definitely an aspect of my Asperger's that plays into that, because Aspies are known for their laser-like focus on minutia. I don't know. For me, I have a great facility for writing magic tricks rapidly. I type 80 words a minute. I usually don't have to stop.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking that reading through the Jennings book, the new Jennings book, simply because it is a book jammed, filled with technical information. And technical writing is, especially in magic books, I think it's an art form, because it can be done so poorly you can barely get through it. I mean, you know, Ed Marlowe's stuff has lots of interesting things, but boy, they're hard to get through.
Very tedious.
So to try to impart the techniques correctly, and at the same time not lose the reader who just gives up on all the minutia that's involved in it, it's a delicate balance. And you're one of the few who do it really well.
Well, thank you. I do it better than I used to. You know, it's always a learning process. I mean, part of the reason I think I'm good at it is because I do everything. You know, when I was first met Ken Krenzel when I was 14 at the governor's cafeteria, he did the panoramic shift for me. I said, oh yeah, I saw Jerry Andrews do that at a lecture at the IBM ring a month ago. I said, will you teach it to me? So he did. And then I did it, and I still do it. But I do everything.
Yeah.
I do all the palms, the passes, the culls, every damn thing that in every book I've written, I had to do. If I don't do it, I can't write it. I know there are writers who don't learn the stuff, but you don't understand pressure. You don't understand gravity. You don't understand balance. You don't understand moisture. There's just so many things you can't know unless you can actually do these things.
Exactly right.
And in all these cases, I've been very fortunate to be taught by the originators.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for a long time, I could do quite a bit of the material out of David Roth's book. But, you know, that fell away because my love is card magic.
Right.
And if someone asked me to do a trick, I would always go to a card trick. It would never occur to me to take out a copper and a silver coin and do a trick.
Right, right.
So I've sort of lost all of that.
And, you know, without somebody who actually can do the stuff that they're writing about, when they're writing about someone else's material, that's when the errors creep in. And that's where you find people getting frustrated. I remember one afternoon you and I were sitting at a restaurant table someplace, and we were talking about the Jennings bottom palm, that crazy one where he reaches under with his little finger.
Oh, yes.
And moves it around to palm it. And you were surprised that I was able to do it. And the only reason was I figured out what was left out of that description.
Right.
Because if you don't figure out what was left out in that, the move is impossible because nobody's hand works that way.
And this is what's left out of that description. This is the description. It's like this. You're supposed to put your pinky under there. Can't do it. This is what's left out.
Exactly.
And then you can put your pinky under there and straighten it. And why exactly is that right. the case? Because Louis Falanga hired Mike Maxwell, who'd never written anything but resumes before. So, you know, what the hell, man? That book is just so totally fucked from first to last. It's, you know.
Well, the good news is.
Larry must have been crushed.
Yeah.
I was talking to John Bannon at some point after the book came out, and he said, I can't figure out the optical add-on. Everybody has to see this move. This is where you're shoving the cards forward with your thumb and you.
Yeah, we talked about it.
Right. And I explained to John that the right-hand cover for the slight is not described. So this is what's described in the text. Like that. Okay. Right. So everybody would see that. This is what's missing from the text. This and that.
Yep.
And as the cards are shoved forward, the fingers close and the hand comes out. And then it's invisible. It's the same thing with Larry's stud bottom deal. The one where you're coming out like that.
Yeah.
The fingers are open over the deck, and then they close as you do that.
Oh.
And this action, which Larry uses not just once, but several times of doing that and doing that, it changes focus, breaks up the spectator's line of vision. Well, how do I know these things? Because I sat down with Larry, and I pressed him, and I pressed him. I said, show me, explain this. I don't understand this. Do it again. Can I see it from this angle? Can I see it from that angle? Now, in Larry's case, he was extremely good at explaining how he did things. He was very, you know, he was a plumber. I don't think he went to high school because he enlisted in the Navy at 16. Despite his lack of education, lack of formal education, he was an incredibly intelligent, articulate person. He read, he was a voluminous reader, science fiction novels, and he could describe everything he did in very, very specific terms. Now, not everybody can do that. When I did Steve Drawn's book, he showed me a move and he explained how it was accomplished. And I said to him, that doesn't make any sense. You're not doing what you think you're doing. And I figured out what he was doing. I said, you're doing this. And he said, no. And then he tried it. He said, you know what? You're right. So sometimes I see what they're doing and they don't know what they're doing. But that was never the case with Jennings. He knew every single, I mean, he spent so much time with Vernon and saw so much Vernon material, including so much that's never been published. And at this point, it's looking like it's lost. But he knew everything, where every finger should go, what every pressure should be. He was a scientist, really a student of the physicality of sleight of hand, who could articulate it. I mean, plenty of guys can do it, but they can't explain it in that detail.
Yeah. You know, that's a thing that I've run into in jazz piano playing, which is so many of the guys can do what they do, but if you ask them to explain what they did, they can't do it. You know, Vernon actually told me a story, because when I talk to Vernon, most of the time I ask not about magicians, but about the musicians that he had seen. And he told me a story of walking through the Carnegie Hall practice rooms and hearing this fantastic piano playing coming out from one of them. And it was Fats Waller. Mm. And so he knocked on the window and he opened it, and there's a bottle of gin on top of the piano. And he says, Mr. Waller, could you show me that lick that you just did? And Waller says, what? No, they play, but you're right. Finding someone who can explain what they're doing and why. And if they can't, then you need a writer such as yourself who can look at it and go, I don't understand what you're doing here, why this works. But you know, it does take somebody with a deep well of knowledge to be able to approach it that way.
Well, I don't know. It's just what I do, Mike.
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, you're like one of those guys. You play what you hear. So let's talk about Jennings a little bit. You met Larry in, what did you say, like the very early 80s? Yeah, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. There it goes, the big book. The big book, fresh off the sea floor. Oh,
this one was sent to me by FedEx. So I actually have one of the first, from the first run of the books. The rest went into the ocean, where Larry did a tussle with Davy Jones, and he lost. And so I'm happy to say the printer reprinted the books, and they're absolutely identical, and they're on the boat and should be here shortly. I met Larry in the first time I went to California. Michael Amar had this idea that I should do an illustrated version of Expert at the Card Table. I should illustrate the book. That was his idea. I said, okay. But I wasn't just satisfied with the idea of doing that. And I also did not do much of the material in Erdnase. So I needed other people's help. Mm-hmm. So I forget how I contacted Vernon. I had not met him before, but he did agree through an intermediary to talk to me about Expert at the Card Table. So that was the reason in January of 1983, I went to Los Angeles. My first trip to Los Angeles, my first trip to the Magic Castle. I walked in the first night. John Carney picked me up at the airport. I stayed with John on that trip, many subsequent trips. And I go into the castle. Where's Vernon? I hear he's always on the couch. Well, he was sitting at the bar, drunk and sleeping, because he had been to some event earlier in the day or the afternoon, and he was fast asleep. So that was a little, I was slightly crestfallen. But anyway, I thought I'd try to make the best of the evening, and I'm standing at the bar. At the other end of the bar at some point, I noticed Larry Jennings. I'd never met Larry before, but you couldn't miss Larry. He was a big fellow, not fat, big. A big beard. And I walked over and introduced myself. And he said, boy, I've got a bone to pick with you. He was kind of like a pirate. I've got a bone to pick with you, boy. And he was very angry about some of the material in the Derek Dingle book I had done the previous year. Now, some of the things he was angry about. First, he said, half of the material in that book is mine. And I said, oh, really? What? Exactly what things? So some of the things were he was angry about were Derek's variations of some of his tricks. You know, he and Derek got along. I mean, they were like two titans.
Yeah.
Two gods on Mount Olympus. Very few people were in that rarefied, level.
Yeah.
And they were friendly, but a bit competitive. So he was grumpy if Derek improved one of his tricks. So I explained that it was not the same. But there were, in fact, things in Derek's book that were exactly the same as Larry's.
Mm-hmm.
The angle steal and Derek's trick, Too Many Cards, is exactly Larry's ambitious classic, but with better pattern.
Right.
And there might have been something else. So, I mean, I just said, you know, you're right. I'm sorry. I didn't know. Derek didn't tell me. So I think he was sort of caught off guard by the fact I admitted it and didn't start yelling at him. I'm not a big guy. I'm not going to yell at Larry Jennings. And so he started doing tricks for me once I got past the test at the beginning. I'd say he must have done 50 tricks for me that night.
Wow.
And then we, at some point, John Carney said, I got to go home, Richard. You got to go home. So I said, Larry, I'm going to John Carney's house. Would you like to come? So he'd gotten his big boat because he drove this gigantic Lincoln Continental convertible, bright red. And we drove to John's house. He was sharing a house with Martin Lewis. I was sleeping on the couch. Larry was very drunk, as by that point, as he was very often. And so we went in the house, and he sat down in the chair, and I sat on the couch, which was where I was sleeping. And he starts doing tricks. And he just kicked my butt. Man, I'm telling you, I, having grown up around so many good people, Derek and Gene Mays and Ken Krenzel and Harry Lorraine and blah, 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 Slidini, whoever the hell else, a lot of people, all very good. Larry just crushed me. And at one point, I said, Larry, I got to go to sleep. I'm so tired. And he had nodded off. He was sitting in the chair sort of like that.
Yeah.
I turn off the light and started to go to sleep like a minute later. God damn it. Who turned off the light? Turn on that fucking light and I'll show you some more tricks. And I turned the light back on and he just kept going. Kept going and going. And eventually, you know, he said, that's good. I'll see you tomorrow. And then he left. And we were fast friends from that point on. And I had not, did not need to go beyond that night to know that it was imperative that I do books with him. And he was under some, he was tied to Jeff Busby with some bullshit contract. Which, and it took a while with Bob Farmer to sort of get that out of the way because it was an illegal contract. It had no validity. And once I got that out of the way and I was started working on the book with Larry, then Louis Falonga jumped in, pushed me out of the way, hired me to do the drawings, fired me the next day and hired Tom Gagnon, hired Mike Maxwell, who had no idea what he was doing. He couldn't do the material. He didn't understand the material and was too stupid to ask Larry questions. Larry's corrections on the text did not get put in.
No.
I mean, it's just such a mess. And anyway, you know, that went on for a while. And then around 1990, Larry and I started work on what I envisioned as two huge books, because it was so much material.
Sure.
And so this is the easy book, right? This is the book. This book has no palms, no material, no palms, no culls, no passes, no half passes, nothing difficult.
Right.
Everything is multiple lifts, work on the double undercut, Biddle type stuff. It's fascinating to me that, I mean, Larry loved all these slides. And every single one of them he improved. Many of them simply by getting rid of the right thumb tip break at the back of the packet.
Right.
Because no one can hide that.
Right.
Okay. And he used the Verdinase break for everything. So if you any slight you do, whether it's just even the simple Browie reverse, if you use a Verdinase break, every dirty bit goes away. It's completely hidden. It's no more difficult to do. You know, anyway, so I had a more, this is just the easy material. So what is this book? Almost 600 pages. The difficult material was the second book, Mr. Jennings Takes It Tough. And I had the titles because I had to decide on the titles to get Larry to sign the pages for the deluxe editions.
Ah.
So he was fine with the titles and signed the pages, was happy to do so. But we kind of knew he wasn't going to see all the books.
Sure.
Even in 1990, he had no feeling in his feet.
Yeah.
He's diabetic, had diabetic neuropathy. Thus, he was still drinking. He never drank at home. Never. Only drank when he went to the castle. So if he wasn't at the castle, he wasn't drinking. But, I mean, he had all kinds of things wrong with him. So
right. And he was a smoker for a long time.
Oh, many. Chain smoker.
Yeah.
And heavy drinker.
Yeah. So not so a...
So we decided in 1990... At the beginning of 1990, or end of 1995, I decided I would do a book before the two big books. Because by then he was quite ill.
Yeah.
And I really wanted him to see a book. So that's when I came up with the idea to do Jennings 67, which would be all this early material. And I don't think the book hangs together particularly well, but there's a lot of good material in it. Some incredible material in it. So I did the book. I wrote it, got it illustrated by Earl Oakes, laid it out, sent it to the printer. But nobody in California told me how ill Larry was. He was talking to his mother during the day, literally sitting in his chair talking to his mother, who had been dead for many years.
Yeah.
And so he did not, the book was at the printer when he died. He did not see the book.
Yeah.
But he had given me everything I needed. I shot 18 hours of video. I have 90 audio cassettes of material he sent me. It's just, and then John Rockerbaum also had maybe a dozen audio cassettes, which he sent me, which Larry had sent to him. You know, Larry would communicate with people by audio cassette, including Alex Elmsley and Roy Walton. But they would tape over the material and send the cassette back. Right. So all of Roy's tapes to Larry are gone because Larry would tape over them and send them back. Just tons of material gone that way. I've never found all of Larry's. Larry took physical notes on Vernon's material. I mean, the idea for the castle, for the what became the Castle Notebooks was Larry's idea because Larry couldn't spell and he had a tough time writing. So he asked Bruce to come out to California and take the notes. Larry would talk to the professor and come home and then tell Bruce what Vernon had told him. Because when Bruce came out, Vernon hated him, wouldn't talk to him.
Wow.
So Larry was the conduit for all of that material. I mean, eventually Vernon warmed up to Servan, but his relationship with Bruce was nothing like his relationship with Larry. Vernon and Larry were very close, like father and son. And why was I telling you that? Oh, so Larry made a lot of notes on Vernon material, and I haven't been able to find those. He told me that he had told BJ to burn them when he died. They're all on yellow legal paper.
Oh.
And they have never turned up.
Well, it was certainly not in any of the stuff that Lisa and I saw when we were sorting through the when we sold that stuff for her on eBay years ago. I never saw anything like that. So
no, it's gone.
Yeah, too bad. Too bad.
We're talking about a lot of Vernon material. Coins, cards, ropes, silks.
Wow.
All gone.
Yeah.
I mean, the stuff that's in the Lost Chronicles. I mean, to me, that all should have been one big book. But, you know, it's Falanga trying to milk the market, so.
Yeah. And there, I mean, it is such a gift that those books were published. I mean, they're invaluable. I mean, they're just an astonishing, you know,
peek into the way that
stuff is supposed to look.
They're great.
Yeah.
They suffer from not all being in the same volume, but.
Yeah.
I was not the publisher. I was close. I was close to being the publisher, but doesn't matter.
Oh, well. So I'll tell you a little bit of what I think is fantastic about the Mr. Jennings Takes It Easy. And it's this. There are the moves that are covered, like you say, things like holding a break, getting a break, the double undercuts, and these things that magicians all categorize under this easy thing.
Yeah.
Most everybody, even experienced guys, the only guys I've ever seen who do those moves correctly are guys who had contact with the people who know how to do it correctly, because it's not really described very many places.
No, and Larry,
the right way to do it.
Everybody in New York thumb counted at the inner end of the packet or the deck.
Right.
And that was anathema to Larry. He could almost never thumb count it. And he said, and if I thumb count, I lower the deck. I don't lift up my thumb.
Yes.
And everybody in New York is doing this, you know, yeah, fiddling.
And it sticks. And, you know, it's funny because with my work on Fool Us, I run into these kind of things. And these are the kinds of things that I have to correct with guys who are, you know, doing stuff. And in particular for television, because there's no misdirection in television. So no, if you don't have a better way to do it, then millions of people are going to watch you get a break under two cards.
Yes. I mean, they don't understand what's happening or why the performer is sort of fiddling for a second. It's just not artful sleight of hand. It's not right. Artful card.
Right.
It's not,
right.
If we had a choice, it's right. Not the way we choose to do things. Larry built, I mean, if you look in the tricks in Mr. Jennings Takes It Easy, Larry built in the methods for getting the breaks into the tricks. I mean, occasionally, you know, he would do this to get a break, you know, or push over two and get a break. And he would tilt his hand in at that second, or tilt it down,
right.
You know. And of course, if he had two cards face up on the pack, or any group, or any cards, you know, on the deck, he never picked up. He would have a Greek break from having turned the double down, you know, and then he'd let it pop up so he could reach in. Or he would use Lynn Searle's auto break, where you push down and it pops up here. And you can, I mean, he just, the idea of doing this was so alien to him. And I'm sure he never saw Vernon do it.
Yeah.
You know, never.
So, and it's all there in the book. And it's, and accompanying all these things that you really don't. I mean, I just like the way that Larry talks about the Elmsley count, which is such an odd move that has become the core of so many tricks. It's a move that makes no sense when you think about it, because it's not a way that you would possibly, you know, there's four things, Richard. I don't have to count them one at a time like this, you know.
Well, you know, most people are doing the Elmsley count. They're going like this.
Yes.
Or they're sort of going like this, and there's no clarity. And when Larry did it, it was very clear. The packet started here. The packet didn't start here. The packet started here. And you go one, two, three, four. It's very simple and very clear. It's not like, how many cards is he holding? How many cards is he moving? What the hell's going on there?
Yeah. No. That kind of shuffling thing. So, I think for somebody who actually wants to do card magic, and I think regardless of experience and skill level, it's a book that I think really supplants that information in card college. I mean, card college has its own benefits, but the material is not addressed the way it's addressed in the Mr. Jennings book. And I think it's really going to be, you know, just one of those books that you need to read.
It's very different because this is all Larry Jennings' point of view. His aesthetic and the way he handled cards is 100% of what's in this book. Whereas compilations like Card College, there is no single aesthetic. There's the author's point of view, who's trying to collate all this information from different people and making decisions about other people's material. Jennings is not doing that. Jennings generally used only his own tricks and his own sleights or his own versions of other people's sleights. And so this is a very concentrated flow of material directly from one guy's brain through me, the conduit, I'm just the conduit, into the book. You know, with so many people, when I'm like when I was working with Derek and trying to explain his various forms of the pass in the book, he couldn't explain to me how he was doing all of them. And so I tried to learn them to the best I could and then explain them the best I could. But there's stuff missing there. There's this unknowable information. Now, I give the example of the pass. Everybody I know who does the pass well does it differently. It's because everybody's physicality is different. So maybe that's not the best example, but still, I couldn't get everything I needed from Derek. Whereas with Jennings, when he was teaching me the dozen passes he did, which he knew exactly what he was doing. Mm. I said, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? Well, that's my third finger. I pull down, I push up, I pull in, you know. Derek was doing things very quickly. And when you do things very quickly, your subconscious and muscle memory are doing things you don't necessarily, you can't necessarily verbalize.
Yeah.
Larry didn't do things quickly. Even his pass wasn't the kind of lightning speed that you would expect. So it's easier to know what you're doing if you're not zooming along and relying on muscle memory and your subconscious to fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
But you can't, you can't fault Derek's passes. They're still the best passes I've ever seen, better than anybody else.
And, you know, a portion of that has to simply be how your hands are put together. And that's,
yes.
This is a factor that most magic books don't address, but it's a huge thing. I remember having, maybe it was the Hugard card manipulation books, and he taught some false cuts. And he had one where you have to start with the deck vertical with your thumb hooked over the upper edge and you let cards fall and you, well,
right.
My thumb will not reach over the edge of a deck. My hand's not big enough. And until you sort of, you know, what am I doing wrong? What am I doing? Well, what you're doing wrong is, you know, you don't have the hands for it. So.
Well, interestingly, if you look at the Derek's fingers were all the same length.
Yes.
Essentially. Yes. If you look in the Dingle book, you'll see, because I drew the drawings from photos of his hands, which is very important that you draw the photos from the actual person's hands. You'll see all his fingers are almost the same length.
Yeah.
And that's must have helped him.
Well, it certainly gives the little finger a lot more leverage, perhaps, you know, or something going on when those two fingers and work like that.
The guys I know who have big hands, like Jennings, Krenzel, Jerry Andrus, you know, they would do stuff and you'd think to yourself, wow, having a big hand would help. But if you were really stupid, you'd say to them, gee, that's easy with a big hand. And every one of them would get very angry. Okay, you don't need a big hand to do this.
Yeah.
And now with Jennings' material, because he had a big hand, I mean, it's like my hand's small. My hand's the same size as Vernon's hand because I put my hand against the professor's hand because I was curious. Yeah. So I know my hand's exactly the same size. Jennings, Krenzel, all these guys, their fingers were fully an inch longer than mine. The palm was wider. If you read in Gautier's book, Magic with Apparatus, he talks about a Frenchman named Latipi or Latipi who could palm a card
width-wise. Yes, right. I remember
in
that.
The hand. Right. Now, I mean, this is my hand. This is my palm. I'm just there. So over there you leak, and on this side you leak, right? It's just very tricky. Jennings didn't have these problems. He palmed beautifully, naturally. He had no idea there was a card going up into his palm. You couldn't tell if he was holding out. You didn't know if he was holding out. I also couldn't tell if he was doing a double lift half the time, you know, depending on which lift he used. I mean, if he used the Gordon lift, I recognize the external movement. But he would do, and there the doubles, the lifts are in this book. He would do his handling of some of Vernon's lifts. I couldn't tell if he was turning over a single card or a double card. So I was in the dirt before he even got to the middle of the trick.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. So you got a little video you want to share with us?
Yes. Now let's
see if this works.
Right there. Which isn't, I mean, it looks like they're turning a block of cement. It looks just awful.
The brick turned over, right? Like Reese Creskin did.
Right. That's a poor.
If you have the choice of using a double lift or a top chain, which do you go for? Or does it depend upon the trick? Or the circumstances?
It depends upon the trick. Top change is, in order to do a really good top change, you have to do heavy misdirection, okay? You have to do body swings. You have to misdirect the hell out of people because the fact that you don't even want them to remember that the cards passed each other.
Right.
Whereas a double lift is because you're only turning two cards, it's so damned easy to fool a person that you don't need the misdirection.
Do you feel a double lift is one of those moves that you should not look at the deck when you're doing it?
Of course. I don't think there's any move you should look at the deck when you're doing it.
Uh-huh. What about like a false count, like a packet, if you're counting? Let's say you're doing twisting the aces and you're counting the packet. Would you look at it or not look at it?
Well, you miss so much if you watch yourself. You miss expressions on people's faces.
Uh-huh.
You get a habit. You get into a habit of watching yourself, and you never see the people at the instant of climax.
Uh-huh.
So you lose that look of joy and wonder on your face.
Uh-huh.
When you do something miraculous, if you're looking at your hands, you don't see that. You look up a second late. You want to be looking them in the face when you turn that card over and it's their card. You want to be looking at your hands to see what kind of reaction you're going to get. So you yourself can judge between which is good and which is bad.
Uh-huh.
You do things that don't get a reaction from, you know, it's not good. Just drop it and try something else.
That's great.
So, I mean,
that's really for you.
You get the point.
Yeah. And that conversation is in the book.
Yeah. Yes. Coincidentally, it is in the book.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, what a beautiful thing to say. You miss so much if you watch yourself.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. You've got to look up.
And well, you know, that's always been a philosophy that I've espoused with people, that if you have questions about a trick, the audience will probably give you the answers, but you have to be paying attention. You have to watch what's going on with them. So, well, it's a wonderful book. I know you are eager to get back to work, and I thank you very much for spending time talking about it.
I'm not eager to get back to work. The hell with that.
Well, then I guess I will. Thank you so much, Richard.
All the time. This hour is a vacation to me.
Oh, good. Well, thank you so much for doing it. I really appreciate it. And when will do we know when the books will get here from China, barring bad seas?
Well, at the moment, the books they should be here at the end of this month, end of February. However, there's a big backup at the Port of Los Angeles. There are like 20 to 40 container ships sitting offshore. There's no space for them to dock because there's so much cargo sitting on the dock already that they can't move. So many dock workers are sick or calling in sick. They don't want to come in because of the pandemic. Truckers are sick. I mean, it's
crazy.
What can I do? I can't do anything about it. It's like I couldn't do anything about it when the container ship would hit a storm in the South China Sea and the containers fell off the boat into the ocean. These things are beyond my control. I could tell you 10 years ago, I would have been stomping, screaming. I would have had a stroke followed by a heart attack, followed by death. but I'm 62 now. I can't do anything about these things. That's sort of
It'll be here when it's here.
Yeah, well, that's one of the benefits you get as you grow older. You realize things are beyond your control. And like, what am I going to do?
Right. Well, thank you again. It's great talking to you. We should actually just talk more just to chat because I had a great time. And
yes, I can assure you, I'm always here.
Thank you, Richard Kaufman. Talk to you again sometime.
Bye. Thanks, Mike.
This has been another Conversation with Close. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please be sure to tell your friends. You can like us on Facebook at Michael Close Magic, follow us on Twitter at Mike Close Magic, and visit our website, which is michaelclose.com. If you'd like to help support these podcasts, you can do that at anchor.fm/Michael Close. In that way, we can continue to bring you high quality content. Until next time, so long from the Great White North.